I'm Dr. Matthew Penn, formerly of the University of Oxford, where I've just completed a DPhil in statistics. And I now work for Cent Entertainment, supporting Como 1907, which is an Italian football club, doing data science work for them.
That is an intriguing introduction. My name is Pamvia Bahia. I'm a neuroscientist and a communicator, and I'm also your host for Biology in Numbers, a podcast by the Society for Mathematical Biology, aka SMB. How are you doing today, Matt?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's nice and warm here in England, which is a surprise given it's October, but I'm enjoying it.
How lovely. Of course, I would have to be out of the country so that I can enjoy such weather. So today's episode is actually to discuss a prize-winning paper published in the SMB's journal, The Bulletin of Mathematical Biology. But before we get onto your work, the work that you described, can you tell us more about how you got into the field of research that you did?
Yeah, so I guess the trouble with starting a PhD in epidemiology in 2020 makes it look like you were following the crowd and just kind of going along with where the funding was at the time. But I was actually into epidemiology and mathematical biology more generally and before it was cool. Yeah. So I started, my journey into epidemiology was I did a project alongside Robin Thompson at the University of Oxford, which was kind of on optimal vaccination policies, which was obviously something that became very important once COVID hit and once kind of the global vaccination program started against that. And so from there, from doing that project, it struck me as kind of a really interesting area. Both there were lots of interesting mathematical problems to solve, and also it was obviously very relevant to the world and there was lots of potential impact from it. I think from there, it just seemed like a really good path to follow for the PhD.
And yet somehow you resisted becoming a member of the society.
I did indeed, yeah. I look back at my PhD days and maybe my student days in general and think I should have done more of this, more of the networking, more of the joining of societies and speaking to other academics. I think I can very easily just get caught up in my own problems and sit in my room and think about maths all day. Whereas actually, maybe it's better to go out and talk to other people about maths.
Talking to other people is overrated. So you kind of answered my next question, which is, given that this is a podcast about mathematical biology, I like to probe our guests and find out whether you're team math or team bio.
Yeah, so I did my undergrad degree in mathematics, and a lot of that was kind of very much on the mathematical side rather than doing any biology or science. And so I've always very much been team maths. I love nothing more than kind of sitting down with a difficult problem and trying to come up with a proof for it, even if that problem is not necessarily applicable to the real world. But I think the advantage of mathematical biology is that you're surrounded by all of these people who come from so many different backgrounds. And I think I really appreciate the input from all of the different biologists and scientists in general that I've got to collaborate with over the last few years. So I would say I'm definitely team math, but I'd like a lot of team bio on my team as well so that our work can be useful.
Very nice. Very diplomatic as well. So what's funny is that for most biologists, when you meet people within the field of math biology and you're doing modeling and stuff, we always assume that you're all statisticians. And it's only after marrying a math biologist, I realized how broad the field is and the kind of techniques that you use. So are you one of these people that is more on the stats side?
Yeah, I felt like quite an imposter, actually, into the Department of Statistics. I did like two modules of statistics at the very most in my undergrad. And so I'm much more on the kind of like modeling differential equations kind of side of math bio. Maybe don't tell my current employers because they've employed me as a data scientist. But yeah, it's been very much moving from that pure maths, purish maths background, and then, yeah, getting other people to kind of say what they might want from the statistics and then having to learn on the job.
Okay. So getting back to the paper, since today's edition of the podcast episode is about one of the publications, what did it mean for you to receive the Lee A. Siegel Prize for your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real honor to have got it. I guess it's one of those prizes that you submit this paper and then there's a little box to tick saying, are you a student first author? If so, would you like to be eligible for this prize? We'll get back to you in 2024. And it was 2022 at the time when I ticked that box.
Wow.
And so it was quite a surprise to see the email in more ways than one. But yeah, it was really, I really appreciated the award. It's always nice just to know that someone else has read your paper more than anything else. Yeah. But not only read it and also thought it was worthwhile. And so, yeah, very grateful to the panel who chose the prize, and yeah, very grateful to receive the award.
Nice. Moving on to the paper itself. So the title is Asymptotic Analysis of Optimal Vaccination Policy. So other than the author really loving their alliteration, can you translate this so that a non-expert would be able to understand what the paper was about?
Yeah, so I guess really this is just a lot of jargon to hide behind the fact that what the paper is saying is optimal vaccination policies are really hard to work out. So let's look at some very special cases and hope that we can make a bit of progress in those. So asymptotic analysis is kind of looking at problems where you've made some of the parameters very small or very large, and then what you're doing is looking for the optimal vaccination policy in those very special cases and hoping that, unlike in the general case, you can do something useful with the maths.
Cool. So I will admit to reading very little past the abstract in the introduction, partly because the thing is like an epic 70-odd pages long, which is just unfathomable for a biologist. And also I was in over my head with maths. But what I did glean is that you're interested in the best way to administer vaccines potentially during an epidemic. So can you be more specific in the question that you were trying to answer with this paper?
Yeah, so essentially what we were trying to answer was, can we come up with any scenarios for our different kind of epidemic setups, essentially, in which we can say something very tangible about the optimal vaccination policy? Because you've got this problem, like you summarized very well, of you're maybe in the middle of the epidemic or at the start of the epidemic, you've got a population full of different groups, maybe age groups is the one that you normally consider, and you've got to try and work out who you should vaccinate and in what order. You know, do you maybe start with the people who are most vulnerable to the disease, or do you start with the people who are going to spread it the most? And in the case of COVID, for example, those two groups were very different. And when you try and solve that general problem, you know, you can put it into a numerical optimizer, so you can get the computer to solve it, and it'll give you something. But it'll give you something that's quite hard to explain. It might not necessarily be intuitive, and you don't really know where it's come from, except for the fact it solves your problem. And so instead, we wanted to come up with a few principles that could guide us both when we're explaining these policies and also kind of give us a good starting point when we're thinking about planning things in real world scenarios where maybe you don't know all of the hundreds of parameters exactly that are in this model. So we looked at two special cases. We looked at when there's a small, very vulnerable subgroup in the population. So you might think of that as kind of people who've had organ transplants or are on immunosuppressants. And we also looked at a case where your vaccination supply is very small. So you've only got maybe 1% coverage that you can get in a population. And so, for example, if you've got some stockpiled up, but then you need to wait a long time to generate new supply.
Yeah, all of these, which seem like very relevant problems to our recent experience, right?
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. And I guess we started working on this. Is that true? Did we start working on it before? Yeah, we started working on it before the COVID vaccines had been rolled out in the UK. And so, yeah, it became increasingly relevant as we continued the work.
Yeah, for sure. So the next section of most papers relates to the kind of methods that you use. So at this point, we'll forgive you for getting more technical, as this might be of interest to your math bio colleagues. But can you tell us about the techniques that you use to study this?
Yeah, of course. And hopefully we can avoid going too technical. My wife was very patient with me and listened to me explain many, many times various different iterations of this. So hopefully this makes vague sense. Essentially, the big technique behind it all is asymptotic analysis. So that's in the title. It's not my alliteration. It's the field of the field of maths that it is. And the idea behind that is that we can approximate lots of things, like I said before, when some parameters are small or big. So to kind of illustrate that with a slightly real world example, imagine you're investing in a bank. You start off with £1,000 and your interest rate is 1%. And if you wanted to work out the amount of money you had after 10 years, we all know how to do that. You can do £1,000 times 1.01 to the power of 10, and that'll give you your answer. But unless you're much better at mental math than me, I can't do 1.01 to the 10 in my head. And so instead, we can use the fact that the interest rate is very small in order to make some progress using our asymptotic analysis. So you can make a very simple approximation, which we call a zero order approximation, which is where we just assume that the small thing is zero. And so if we assume the interest rate is zero, then after 10 years, we'll still have £1,000. We'll say thank you very much to the bank. And like that's not super close. But also, if you compared everyone's bank account in the world, £1,000 isn't a bad estimate of what we'll get. But where things start to get really interesting is where we can make what's called a linear or first order approximation to the solution. So in this case, we're still using the 1% interest rate, but we're not considering kind of effects that the 1% interest rate might have on other interest that you've already earned. Because you can imagine after 1 year, we've only earned a very small amount of interest. And the additional interest that we get on that will still be pretty small after 2nd year. So it'll be 1% of 1%, which is 10 pennies in this scenario. And so in this case, we've got 1% interest on a fixed £1,000 for 10 years. And so that gives us a total of £100 in interest and leaves us with £1,100. And that is very, very close to the solution. I think if you work it out, it ends up being about £1,104. And so, yeah, we've been able to use our asymptotic analysis to make a really good guess of the behavior of the problem in a way that's still showing us a bit of the behavior of what's happening. So it's still showing us that our money is increasing when we're investing in this bank, even though the interest rate isn't maybe what we'd hope for.
Okay. And then you use, obviously, a series of equations and things to describe this. So for, as I say, for math bio people, can you tell us the kind of techniques you use?
Yeah, of course. So we started off by modeling the disease with what's called a multi-group SIR model. So we split the population into susceptible, infected, and recovered. I'm sure that's something that most people are familiar with. And we also split the population based on whether or not they've been vaccinated before or getting infected with the disease. And then we further split the population into a certain number of groups. So in the examples we looked at in the paper, it might be a 0 to 10 age group, a 10 to 20 age group. You could split them by geography or, I don't know, height, whatever you want to split people by. Yeah. And then with that model, we then determine an objective function for our vaccination policy. So for a given vaccination policy that satisfies the constraints that we put on it, we calculate a weighted number of people who get infected and people who die. And then that's something that we're trying to minimize. So yeah, overall, we're trying to kind of reduce the impact of the disease, however we might choose to quantify that impact. And then in order to kind of make progress in the solution, we use this asymptotic analysis in our two special cases. And essentially what we're trying to do is linearize our objective function in terms of these small parameters. So firstly, in the small vulnerable subgroup case, we're able to show that kind of to leading order, so that's kind of the main thing that's changing the objective function. The only thing that's affecting it is the number of people who are getting the disease in that very small, very vulnerable subgroup. So in that case, you just show that you need to vaccinate them as quickly as possible in order to minimize your objective. And similarly, in the kind of small vaccination supply case, again, we can make a linearization in that total supply and then calculate the optimal vaccination policy just as a linear function of the percentage of people in each population that we vaccinate. And then that gives us a much simpler objective function to maximize or minimize.
So the numbers that you plug into the models themselves, where do you get those from?
Yeah, so that's one of the kind of perennial problems in epidemiology, that you can come up with these amazing models and there are a lot of parameters to fit. In the examples that we did in the paper, which were not necessarily meant to be kind of the most representative examples, we kind of estimated some quantities for the United Kingdom based on contact matrices. So some people did a lot of surveys and we quoted some papers and used their results and where they tried to work out how much contact different age groups would have with each other in the UK. You can also use the population within each age group. And then that gives you an idea of kind of the transmission rates between all of the different groups within the UK population. In order to kind of apply this to a real disease, you'd need to work out the transmissibility of the disease. And there are lots and lots of papers which are focused on kind of estimating the R number is the media friendly quantity in that case and various other parameters of the disease. You'd also need to work out the effectiveness of your vaccination, not only in kind of preventing serious infection, but also in preventing you from transmitting the disease to other people. And so in order to use this practically, you'd have to do a lot of careful statistical analysis into your parameters. I guess the advantage of a lot of our results, particularly the first one about the small vulnerable subgroup, is you don't actually need to really know much about the disease. All you need to know is that you've got a small group in your population that's very vulnerable. And so it kind of gives you the confidence to, for example, in the example of people who've had organ transplants, it's pretty much always a good idea to vaccinate them first. So you don't need to worry too much about waiting for all of your stats to run. You can just go ahead and start jabbing.
Yeah, for sure. So having talked about the methods that you've used, can you summarize what the results were and what the big take-home message was?
Yeah, so I guess I've maybe accidentally answered some of this question already, but I guess, you know, splitting it into those two sections, in the first case, the result was you should always vaccinate the small vulnerable subgroup. First, because it's asymptotic analysis, these results only hold in something kind of called the limit. So this paper doesn't produce like a fixed boundary where it says if your population is such and such vulnerable and has such and such a size, then you should definitely vaccinate them. And if they're not, then we don't know. It's just a case of kind of if you have a sufficiently small, sufficiently vulnerable population. And then there's an element of judgment still to be made there, but it gives you a principle to guide your vaccination policy. And so it not only provides kind of a useful first guess at what the optimal policy might be, it also, like I said, provides you with something sensible to start with when maybe you don't know too much about the disease or how good the vaccination is. And the second section produced some interesting results on kind of, yeah, exactly how well this approximation performs. So we did some tests in terms of if you had enough vaccination to cover 10% of your population, and the optimal policy suggested by our approximation matched very well with the overall optimal policy. And so that suggests that, yeah, these kind of techniques can be used in quite a wide range of scenarios. And again, particularly if you're in that scenario where you've got some vaccines stockpiled, even if it's a decent number, even if it's in that, you know, maybe 5 to 15% range, you can still use these very simple techniques to give you a kind of good starting point for your what you decide to do.
Very cool. So I personally think that sounds like a very appropriate thing to do under the circumstances and that your work is important. But to some extent, the math bio field is still, I think, trying to convince those in the biology and health fields of the utility of their work, right? So what would you say to convince those researchers to read this paper?
Yeah, so I maybe wouldn't make them read over all of my proofs. They're quite meandery and I'm not sure they're a good advert for maths in many ways. But I think, like, we use a lot of models a lot of the time. And that's true whether you're a biologist or whether you're a mathematician. And it's really important that we know that these models satisfy our intuition. In a sense, like, the results in this paper aren't very surprising. You know, I don't think there's many people standing up and claiming, oh, those vulnerable people, we shouldn't vaccinate them at all. Because yeah, that's just blatantly untrue. But what's important is that the models that we use to make our decisions also satisfy these properties in kind of all reasonable scenarios. Because otherwise, when we put a more complicated scenario into the model where we don't necessarily know what the results are, it's very difficult to kind of make sure that that makes sense, because it's just this complicated string of, well, you should vaccinate such and such a percentage of this population at such and such a time. And so I think there's a real role for mathematics to kind of essentially sanity check all of these models. So similarly, there's another paper which is closely related to this, which we wrote, which was just showing that if you vaccinate more people in this SIR model, then fewer people will get the disease. And again, everyone knows that. No one's really surprised by the result. But I think it's important that mathematicians and biologists work together to make sure that the models that are being used kind of, yeah, satisfy these basic conditions, or there's more trust in them as we apply them to more complicated scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. When writing a paper, we're often limited in how much information you can put into that publication, right? So were there any outtakes that didn't make it into this particular one?
Yeah, there were. I would say my floor probably had about 2-3 inches of scrap paper on it at various points of this paper writing process of proofs, which ultimately turned out to be false. I think, honestly, wading through, like, yeah, all of those would give you quite a worrying insight into my mind, I think, my occasional lack of knowledge of basic maths. But yeah, it was quite a process. So yeah, so there's lots of kind of essentially errors and failed attempts, which didn't make it into the paper. I think there's also, you know, I think something like this, it's almost an endless question, right? Like, of, oh, what scenarios can we think of where we're going to be able to find interesting results? So there's lots of kind of other things you could try with the parameters. There's also lots of other constraints you could put in the model. So for example, one of the big things which it doesn't consider is the fact that vaccination efficacy decays over time. So, you know, sometimes you actually don't want to vaccinate all of your vulnerable people. If you think of the flu, for example, we don't vaccinate people in June because their vaccine would have worn off by the time we hit peak season. And so, yeah, I think kind of revisiting these results, particularly in that case of the decays in vaccination efficacy, would be really interesting. And yeah, something that would merit further investigation.
Very cool. So thank you very much for the summary on the paper. One of the questions that I didn't include in my list for you initially, and this is related to the fact that the work that you're doing now is completely unrelated to your epidemiology work. So tell us where you're working and what you're doing and how you ended up there.
Yeah, so it is quite a sidestep away from what I was doing in my PhD. So I now work as a data scientist for an Italian football club, so Como 1907, who got promoted to Serie A last summer, which is the top division in Italy for the many of you, I assume, who don't necessarily follow football as closely as me. And yeah, it's been something that I've been doing on the side for a long time. So while I was doing my PhD, I was also working with Oxford City and Oxford United football clubs, who are the two big teams in Oxford. And yeah, it's just been, it's been a really, really interesting experience. I've kind of grown up as a huge football fan, realized quite early on that I was never going to make it as a player, although maybe not quite as early on as my parents, I think. I was holding on to false hope for quite a while. And yeah, it's just been, it kind of struck me that as much as my skills on the pitch are not going to get me anywhere, that kind of all of this statistics, all of this modeling, all of this experience I had approaching problems and kind of getting useful outputs by using the maths that I'd learned, and that this could easily be applied to football as well. And it's actually a great time to be working in football. The data science industry is really booming. The data is becoming increasingly available, and the kind of scale of data that you've got access to as well is increasing really, really rapidly. Like 10 years ago to now is an enormous change. And so, yeah, it's been a fun adventure, although it's definitely less useful than mathematical biology, which is the one unfortunate thing about it.
Yeah, but it is a testament to kind of like the transferable skills that we learn during whatever kind of academic research we do.
Definitely, definitely. And I think, like I said before, it's one of the great things about maths bio is you get to work with so many different people. And I think I use a lot of the things I've learned from people not necessarily from the mathematical field. You know, that experience of someone comes to you with some data and you've got to do something with it. That is 100% what happens in football as well as in the biology world.
Very cool. So thank you very much for answering all my questions. But before we let you go, we have a little segment where we try and get people to learn more about the person behind the researcher. So of the quick fire questions, my first one is, what are common misconceptions about your job?
Yeah, so I once spoke to someone when I told them I worked as an analyst for a football club who heard me as announcer, and they thought that I stood at the stadium and shouted out the substitutions, which I honestly thought would be quite fun. But that was a surprising misconception. A more common one is just that working in football, data just involves kind of counting passes and producing the little graphics that go on like BBC Sport or something like that after a game. And actually, like I said, you use a lot more complicated maths.
So what does your maths show? What is it you're trying to work out for a football
game? Yeah, so it's a range of things, really. I guess the kind of easiest area to apply it to is player recruitment. So you'll build a model that will say, if we bring this player in from this country, then we expect them to do this well in our team. We expect them to play well with these other players. And then that also translates into kind of preparing for matches and evaluating performances after matches. So providing some advice to the coaches about maybe what tactics work, what tactics might work against a particular team. And so, yeah, really trying to kind of understand and predict what's going to happen. And that's essentially every problem in football is what will happen next weekend, what will happen in a year's time, like, and what can we do about that?
Okay, so this sounds like the football equivalent of the subject of Moneyball, right? The movie based on baseball.
It is true. It's true. Yeah, it's very similar. I would be snotty and say baseball's much easier to model than football because you've just got a guy hitting a ball. But yeah, it's essentially the same.
Fair enough. So my second question is, are you more productive in the night or in the morning?
Yeah, so I think my best mathematical thoughts and also a large set of my worst mathematical thoughts have happened while lying in bed, thinking about proofs instead of going to sleep. I have convinced myself that I've proved the collapse conjecture, which is a hugely unprovable mathematical problem, 100 times in bed. And all of those 100 times they've been wrong. But occasionally I do have a good idea. And I think that's probably where kind of my favorite work from my PhD came from. In terms of actually doing work that's reliably going to be used in the future, definitely during the day, although not too early. Like I maybe hit my peak around 3 p.m.
Very good. I'm also having flashbacks to my A-level mathematics, which I was proving things in my sleep and I woke up I'm like, what the hell was that?
Yeah. I know sometimes you think, right, that maybe in your sleep you did have it right and now you've just forgotten.
It was utter gibberish.
Yeah.
My final question for you is, if you were featured on the local news, what would you most likely be on there for?
I can often convince myself to, I don't know quite the best way to describe this, but you know when you're in a conversation with a friend and they're like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if someone did this? And then you kind of take it slightly too seriously and you end up doing it. As an example, one of these conversations that ended up getting me recorded on a video, which I really shouldn't have been in, was we had a conversation about how funny it might be to do a rap, dressed as a rap, because I had this burrito blanket. And so I got convinced to go outside the Mathematical Institute in Oxford and do a rap about, I can't even remember what it was, I think possibly a rap about a rap. And that was one of the worst experiences of my life, but also very possibly could have been made even worse by the local news picking up. So I fear that that is maybe my penchant for, I don't know, following through on stupid things that people suggest. Get me some.
Here's me thinking, I was asking a leading question, like you might talk about modelling football teams' progress. The rap about
I feel like no one wants to listen to people talk about maths on the news, but people really do want to watch people do stupid things.
That's a fair point. On that note, this, I can assure you, has not been a stupid conversation. I very much enjoyed it. So yeah, thank you so much for your time today, Matt.
No, not at all. It's been lovely to meet you and lovely to come on the show. Thank you.
Lovely, thank you. You've been listening to Biology in Numbers, a podcast from the Society for Mathematical Biology and produced by me, Pamfe Bahia, at Up Science Media. A reminder that if you're doing cool stuff within the field of math biology and you'd like a chance to be featured, email Jane Heffernan at president@smb.org. Make sure that you go ahead and pitch your research project, your involvement with SMB, and why you think you should be featured, and we'll look forward to picking some new stars for the pod. As always, you can learn more about SMB on the website smb.org and via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Find the links to all of these and some for today's guest in the episode show notes. Finally, don't forget to subscribe via your favourite platform, and if you like the show, give us some love by reviewing.
I'm just going to cough.